My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the privilege of speaking with Scott Simon. Scott Simon, welcome to KBOO and welcome to Portland.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you here because very often, not to rat out my sister stations here in town, but usually OPB grabs people like you and keeps them incognito for the entire time they're in town.
Oh, that wouldn't I have no wish to be incognito.
Incognito, yeah, I don't blame them. Okay, let me tell you.
I just discovered here in Portland?
What's that?
The food trucks.
Oh, man. Well, we've been in the New York Times three times for our food trucks.
That. Oh, my gosh, they're wonderful.
Yeah, they are.
Forgive me, I'm just coming from a kimchi quesadilla.
the mind reels.
No, exactly.
Okay, kimchi
quesadilla. I beg your pardon, go ahead.
Yeah, this is a whole other conversation. We're here to talk about your book. Let me talk about you first. I think everybody knows Scott's voice. He's been with NPR since the Jurassic period. How long have you been doing Weekend Saturday?
I guess about 25 years.
25 years, wow. And it's still fresh. That's really amazing.
It is, yes.
Okay, so you've reported from all 50 states, 5 continents, 10 wars, mm-hmm. El Salvador to Sarajevo to Afghanistan and Iraq. Your books have chronicled character and characters in War and Peace, Sports and Art, Tragedy and Comedy. This is a bit grand, isn't it?
Yeah.
Your show has been described in the Washington Post as the most literate, witty, moving, and just plain interesting new show on any dial.
Well, I hope that's okay.
They haven't seen Glenn Beck, clearly. You've contributed articles to the New York Times, the LA Times, the New York Times Book Review, Wall Street Journal, on infinitum. Now, here's the real deal. You're a native of Chicago.
Yes.
You're one of those people like John Cusack who loves Chicago, but mostly from a distance.
Well, I'm in Chicago a lot.
You are in Chicago.
If I could be in Chicago more, I would. I think John's in Chicago a fair amount, too, if I'm not mistaken.
It's a great town. I just don't want to be in there in the winter. Oh, my God. You like Mexican cooking, and you bleed about the Chicago Cubs.
I do.
As a Brooklyn Dodger fan, I empathize. So, you appeared as Mother Ginger in the Austin Ballet production of The Nutcracker.
I did, indeed, and I had a terrific... have you ever seen a production of...
Nutcracker?
Yeah, sure.
Hasn't everybody?
Okay. Mother Ginger, they gave me a pair of, if I say so myself, stupendous breasts to play the role.
Yes.
And we just had the one daughter then, thought they were the funniest thing in the world, and misses them, even now.
Hey, Mama, tell people about the time you were Mother Ginger.
She wants me to talk about that.
You should call up the ballet in Austin and have them send you the gear. I mean, Halloween is coming up, you know.
That's true.
Yeah, okay. All right, so this is really, we're getting into the important stuff now. You're married to Caroline Richard,
yes.
who was a fan of the Yankees, boo, and the French national soccer team, about which I'm indifferent.
She's French, yes.
Okay, yes. Okay. And you have two daughters, Elise and Lena, short for Paulina, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, okay. Now, the title of your book is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, Scott Simon. It's published by Random House. And it's about adoption. Mm-hmm. You have two little Chinese girls.
Yeah.
Things happen when you adopt from China. It's a big process to do it.
Yeah.
People throw bureaucratic things in your pathway, your forms to fill out. You fly over there and you may not get your kid at all. You want to describe,
We did it twice, and with the advantage of hindsight, everything went fine. I mean, the waiting period in each case, we were told the first time the wait would be about 9 months, it turned out to be 18. We were told the second time the wait would be about a year, it turned out to be 2 years. I mean, now that it's over, fine. But during that time, you're very anxious about it, and you're very anxious that something, the only reason, your mind plays tricks on you. You think the only reason there could be any kind of delay is that something has gone wrong. Something's about to go wrong, which in neither case it wasn't. The forms you fill out are, most of them, only valid for a year, for reasons which I respect. But it means that when you're done filling out the forms and done paying the fees and done going through the interviews, you have to do it all over again. And that, the kind of frustration that can build up. And it's the sort of thing where, the psychology, I think my wife and I call it the father of the bride psychology, based on the old Steve Martin remake. You don't blanch at writing another check for several thousands of dollars to adopt a child. But then when you're told it costs $350 to photocopy the documents, then you can take the same sheaf of documents down to Kinko's and have them photocopied for $5.
35 cents, yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's when you get...
Mm-hmm. That 350 for 350. It must be the high labor costs in China that do it.
Yes, well, because it's all union labor after all, and they're all paid top drawer salaries.
And we know that because the working conditions there are so good.
Exactly.
That's this is what happens when you deal with totalitarian regimes like China and Microsoft. This is what happens to you. Okay. Now, I don't have any kids, but we have a cousin here in Portland who adopted two little Chinese girls.
Yeah.
One she got as an infant. I believe Jinmei was...
Jinmei?
Yes.
Jinmei,
yes.
Okay, Jinmei is...
yes, I noticed the similarity.
Yeah.
She was about 9 months, I think, finally, when Nancy got her. Second girl was almost 10 years old, just a few weeks shy of 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And the problems were substantially different. Now, with babies, you know, babies are pretty much babies. They're fairly adoptable, although... your old Elise, had some adaptability problems.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even call them problems. And if I do in the book, I apologize for it. They're just things to deal with. They're sensitivities.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, it's like calling our tantrums a problem. Not really. Tantrums are actually a sign of healthy development. And I think some of the emotional stuff that Elise is going through, even as we speak.
How old is she now?
She's seven.
Seven.
Are occasioned by the fact that she, we are her parents, she loves us, so anything she suffered very early in her life, she holds us personally responsible for not getting her earlier, and that's kind of healthy. You know, and she's smart, and she's got a restless, probing mind, and she fills in the blanks, and so she asks questions.
You know, there's a long tradition in China of strong women.
Yeah.
And even though they don't have the best road to hoe in China, the women there are quite strong. And the fact that they're
actually they're hoeing the roads often in China.
Well, yes,
you could use that. Yeah,
the fact that they're able to survive in a culture like that is very interesting. Do you see that in both your girls? Do they have that inner strength?
Oh boy, yes, absolutely. And in the older one in particular, who kind of, you know, takes on the world in a way, and for her little sister, in a way that I really admire. There is nothing shy, there's nothing wilting about either of them, and I really enjoy that. And I relate this in the book. Elise and Lena, it was one of those nights we had them out to dinner with family, and... You know, I have learned, forgive a baseball analogy, that a parent has to be a little bit like a baseball manager in that, you know, when a pitcher reaches a pitch count, even if things are going well, a smart manager will remove him so that he doesn't give up a home run as his first sign of fatigue.
Told you I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan.
That's right. Well, yeah, of course, yeah, yeah, you know, yeah. you would know. Well, you know, it was just going on late. The service was slow. We should have pulled him earlier. We didn't. And it was that particular night that Elise said to us, "I was hungry." And my wife, Caroline, said to her in French, my wife is French, so French is our family language, said to her, "Well, you left plenty of food on the plate back there." And Elise said, "No, in my mother's stomach, I was hungry." Now, does she have any conscious memory of that? I think, of course not. But she's a smart kid, and she fills in the blanks. And then she said, "Why didn't you come get me?"
This kid knows how to word guilt incredibly.
Well,
she's like a knife expert. This kid.
No, yes, exactly. She's very smart, and I in any event, my wife delivered to her in French just a wonderful little speech where she said, "Look, everything that makes you different now, that might make you feel a little uncomfortable, very soon, and I mean very soon, you're going to wind up being proud of it." She said, you know, so everything that you might see as some kind of drawback now, it's going to wind up being a strength. And then she said, "And darling, I know you will be strong." And I've sensed that in both our little girls.
I don't want to sandbag you with this. It might be an uncomfortable question. There are a lot of babies in this country that need adopting. Why go to China?
You know, it was as simple as it was very difficult to qualify in any good time for a domestic adoption program. Frank DeFord, who I also write, because I write about a dozen other families in the book, too. We just don't base it on our experience. Frank was over 40, as I was when we began to adopt. And you're just put, in most domestic adoption programs, you're put at the back of the line.
Is that right?
They want, you know, younger parents, which for every adoption program makes their own provision. Now, had we think, opened ourselves to adopting a child from a domestic program, family services program, an older child, the wait might have been a good deal less. But, you know, my wife and I hadn't been parents before, and we didn't know as we'd be good for a 10-year-old child. I mean, if circumstances had worked out, that was the only thing, that's what we would have done. But we just didn't qualify for any domestic program in any good time. At the time we applied in China, the wait was, we were told, after being approved, just 9 months. And that just sounded good to us, because we'd been trying to start a family for 4 years at that point. And 9 months sounded like a good bet. And, you know,
it was a pregnant time, wasn't it?
Well, that struck us.
Yes.
Because, you know, you do look for those signs. I mean, when my wife and I fell in love, she was living on Mott Street in Chinatown in New York. And, of course, it's illogical, but we said to each other, well, China, my
God.
You
got her to move to Washington, D.C.? That's amazing.
Pardon me, what?
You got her to move to Washington, D.C.?
I can't believe it, yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe she just got tired of the bugs.
Well, remember, she's French. I'm sure she just needed a green card. We make a joke because my wife is a famously beautiful woman, and, you know, and doesn't need anything from me.
Okay, now I've seen this a little bit with my two cousins, my two little Chinese cousins. The older one, her name is Xin Xu. She spent all that time in orphanages and foster homes, yeah, and was neglected terribly, and came over, yeah, here without the stimulation that a kid that age normally has, okay?
Yeah.
But one of the things is that at some point, these kids have to look around and say, you know, Mary Ann's, she looks like her parents, and Charlie, he looks like his parents. I don't look like my parents. What's the deal here?
I think our kids already know that. I mean, we've pointed it out. So it's not, I don't think it's going to be any particular surprise. I also think, not to be a Pollyanna about it, our little girls are growing up in a substantially different time and place. They are hardly in their classes and in their, you know, their running girl gangs of friends. They're hardly the only kids who were adopted, and hardly the only kids who were adopted from overseas. And, you know, families are all mixed up in this country now. We really are. Certainly almost every family we know has some kind of difference. When my parents married in the 1950s, a Spanish Jewish man and a Irish Catholic woman, that was considered a mixed marriage.
Oh, yeah.
I think absolutely nothing of that now. And I think the mixture of America, really all across the country, it's no longer just the major cities, but the mixture of America is just growing so great. And even within families, I don't know if that's going to create the sense of surprise. Now, are there good, honest, just curious questions? Yeah, absolutely. But I don't read much into that. I mean, you know, Lisa's gone through a period already where she'd like to have curly hair like yours, Ed,
I must say.
But I've been told every little girl will go through a period where she wants curly hair or wonders what life would be like if she were blonde or all that kind of stuff. And I guess I'm eager not to consider that a trauma or some kind of drawback, just because our children don't really look like us. And, you know, what's funny, what happens to us really almost once a month, if not more, is people will come up to my wife in public when she has her two little daughters, and someone will say, you know, your daughters are so beautiful, and they could almost be Chinese. So, you know, in fact, they do look a little like her.
I don't mean to be fishing in troubled waters, yeah, but people will, yeah, want to know these things because there are still plenty of people who want to adopt and will be adopting from overseas.
Yeah.
There are Ethiopian adoptions.
Yeah.
There are the tragic Romanian adoptions because of the way the children were treated in the orphanages,
yeah,
in Romania. It may still be. I don't know.
Yeah.
And, of course, China, Korea have been a place to adopt children for a long, long time. So let me remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Scott Simon. The title of his book is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, published by Random House. And it's about adoption. One of the people that you mentioned in the book is a local saint, a guy named Thomas Lauderdale.
Yeah.
I don't know how much you know about, I mean, you seem to know him fairly well from the chapter in,
yeah,
the book, but I've been peripherally involved twice with him, benefits for people, one for a man who couldn't pay his medical bills,
yeah,
a friend of mine. The other one was a friend of mine, too, whose bookstore burned down. He had no insurance. And Thomas Lauderdale gave of his time, gave of his effort.
Yeah.
This guy, if you tell him somebody needs him,
yeah,
he will show up there.
Yeah,
how did you meet Thomas Lauderdale?
I interview him. That's how do I meet almost everybody these, mm-hmm, days? Over for 25 years at this point, and liked him very much. And he knew the story of our family. I didn't know his story, but then he volunteered that. And it seemed, gotten to know each other over the years. In fact, very, you know, he threw a birthday party for me once when I happened to be in Portland.
Lucky you.
It was great. Yes, absolutely. It is downtown headquarters here. And, you know, have seen him in New York and seen him in D.C. and in Chicago. And in any event, I said, would you ever consider talking about that in your family? And he did. And his father, Kirby, and his mother, Linda. And, you know, it's... As Kirby, the Reverend Lauderdale, who's Thomas's father, says, Thomas is obviously a famous success. As Kirby says, we just put him on his feet, and we've been following him ever since. He's a musical genius. He is a genius. He's a, you know, not just a genius. He's a man of such fine character. And unfortunately, he had a younger sister who met with an unfortunate end. She actually met her birth family for one reason or another, got tied up with drugs, went into a tailspin. And Kirby said something to me that I think is very well taken. He said, my wife and I, ex-wife now, Linda, and I have concluded that we don't deserve half the praise that people heap on us for what Thomas has done. Because people will say to them, well, you see, look what Tom, it just shows you. You adopt a kid and give him love and look what can happen. He can be Tom Lauderdale. She said, and he said, you know, we probably don't deserve half the blame we still heap on ourselves for what happened to his sister. And so
that's an awfully elevated analysis.
It took him years of pain to get there too, uh-huh. because I think his instinctive reaction, as any parent would be to blame yourself for what happened to your daughter. More so than to take credit for the nice things that happened to your son. And it just underscores, I don't like grading adoptions like successful or failed. I think every adoption is a success in that it gives, like every birth, it gives the world a fresh new chance to be reborn. I also think, look, the Kennedys, the Bushes, the Rockefellers, not like they haven't had their problems, not like they haven't had their lives caught up in drugs, people doing nefarious things, failure in the parental, you know, child relationship. You know, it happens in the wealthiest families, the so-called best
money
families.
Is no guard against anything.
Yeah, and for that matter, you know, years of genetic development or whatever they have, or lack of development in those families. And I just think, you know, adoptive families probably have the same range and some of the same problems that they have to treat. It's just, I don't like adoption itself as being treated as the trauma. Because I don't think it is at all. I think it's a circumstance in life. It's a fact of life that you have to deal with. But Jeff Seller, another family fellow who's profiled in the book, Jeff was adopted by a family in suburban Detroit. He and his partner, Josh, now have two youngsters, a boy and a girl that they've adopted. And as Jeff says, look, it's a rough way to begin in life. If that relationship with your mother, particularly the mother more than the father, I don't mind saying, is broken, it's a rough way to begin in life. But you know what? That's what growing up is all about. We lose things, we go on. We suffer reverses, we get stronger because of it, we go on. And as Jeff says, if you're determined to make this the one thing you never get over and you're always going to treat as a trauma, you can do that. But this is the only life you're ever going to have. So why not just build from there? Why not? And on the contrary, I like there are people like Thomas Lauderdale, like my colleague at NPR, Steve Inskeep, who talk about adoption being kind of a motivating factor. They're both very comfortable with their identity as people who've been adopted. You know, Thomas says, I like being this mystery Asian. He's a man of the world. He's a man of his music. He has created his own identity. And I find that very healthy.
Yeah, it's quite an identity, too. He's a very self-motivated and focused guy. Absolutely. And when you look at him, you know, when you first meet him, you think maybe that's it's not there. I mean, not that you would really think about it. Then all of a sudden, something snaps behind his eyes, and he's there 105%. It's really quite amazing. Yeah. Let me ask you a general question about something that is bothering me. Maybe you know something about it. And in a culture like China, where girls are not valued, they've been giving away their girls for a long time, to the extent now that I think they might be beginning to realize that they're giving away their future by giving away all these girls, that now that there are more young men in certain age groups than there are girls in those age groups, this goes back a long way. The ancient Greeks used to leave girl babies exposed to the elements to die. There was an article in the New York Times about 2-3 weeks ago about Afghan girls that are being raised as boys because the parents are embarrassed that they don't have any boys. Yeah. So until this girl reaches puberty, she is treated and dressed like a boy. What the hell's going on? I mean, what is there? what is there in the human character that gives? I don't even know if that's a good question because it's so open ended. But what can you do with it?
You know, I don't know, and I don't mind saying it plots a little bit because I think our daughters are going to ask the same damn question, and they're not going to wait. I mean, I think this is coming at me in the next 2 or 3 years, from at least our oldest daughter, and you know, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I can be very programmatic. You know, in China, they have a phrase that that having a daughter is water in your neighbor's fields. Because, the girl won't be used in farm work the same way that a boy would. And some of it, in fact, might date to that, the whole question of utility. And obviously, there's some parts, some zip codes, if I'm going to put it this way, in China, where that's not the case at all. In modern Shanghai and Beijing, of course, that's there are a lot, including Elise's, our oldest daughter's godmother, Han Feng, who's a fashion designer of some note in Shanghai, goes back and forth between Shanghai and New York. I don't know the answer to that, but this is interesting because I want people to understand. My wife and I do find what we call the state family planning policies, the one-child policy of China, to be reprehensible. I mean, I think it's important people to understand, in China, women do not have the right to choose, as we understand it here. They do not have the right to choose to have their baby. Each of our daughters, I think it's safe to assume, were born of women who defied the law to either have their child or to relinquish their child to put her in a place where she was confident that she would be discovered and hope that might win the lottery to have a life's lottery to have a better life. And we didn't set out to adopt from China because we find that policy so reprehensible. We somehow wanted to, you know, pluck two girls away from there while we had the chance. But, and this is how adoption transforms, we are a half Chinese family now. We have adopted two little girls from China, and therefore we are obliged to know more about it and to care about it and to, you know, to put our values into some proximity so that we try and handle this with our daughters, because they're not strangers anymore. This is not an intellectual proposition. They're our daughters. And I think one day when we have one of these reunions that as we did just on Saturday night with some of the people who other families who were with us when we got our daughters, you know, at some point, I think the little girls themselves are going to turn around and say, hey, how come we're all girls? And, we give a certain answer now that Elise is 7. I think by the time, you know, she's 10, we just fill in the blanks as best we can.
You know, there's one of the crassest things that the Chinese government has done in a whole universe of crass things is that now they've started giving up boys, but they're boys with special needs. It's their version of the Mariel boat lift. They're getting rid of their undesirables. I find that so horrifying. Not that there's anything wrong with these kids or taking one of these kids.
Absolutely not. No,
but it's their perception. Their perception is they're cleaning house.
Well, and, you know, I particularly when this fairly new, or now I guess they're almost 2 years old, series of prohibitions that tighten.
No fat people, no middle-aged people.
No fat people, no middle-aged people, no gays.
Yeah.
And that, I must say, I find especially reprehensible because I'm sorry if this caters to any cheap stereotypes, but we have a lot of friends who are gay parents, and they are the best parents we know. I mean, they're the ones who come to the playground after school. They've got the snacks. They've got the sippy cups and the juicy juice boxes. They have considered parenthood. It means so much to them. They've contemplated their responsibilities. They're very serious about being great parents. And it just underscores for me that the Chinese government that does not have the best interest of the kids at heart at all.
You know, the only thing you need to be a parent is a set of functioning genitalia. And this gives you no particular insight, intelligence, or emotional depth to raise a child. Yeah. Anybody who chooses to take a child, I think right away they're at a higher level than one who's given a child by chance. And maybe that's a wrong thing to say, but
I'm sure there's some people who hear it the wrong way, but I believe that, which is not to say those of us who are adopting parents don't make plenty of mistakes, I'm sure.
Well, all parents make mistakes. Look at us.
That's right. Look at us. We're sitting here. But I think that's absolutely true. And I think adoptive families almost have an advantage that way, because the families have thought about it. You know, and we have to utter things to each other aloud that I think in some families go left unsaid because you think, oh, it's assumed. You know, you're my son, you're my daughter. Of course, you love me, huh? I love you. We all know that, right? Right, right. Well, in adoptive families, you don't leave that unuttered and you don't leave the relationship unexamined. And I think there's that advantage in adoptive families, which I think is to everybody's benefit and just makes the experience much richer, certainly more intense.
There's the ongoing debate over nature versus nurture.
Yeah.
Now, in the case of an adopted family, regardless of where the adopted child comes from, it's all nurture. It's what the child turns out to be, whatever yeah. the DNA impelled behaviors there are or ideas. The way you raise a child is going to have a profound effect. Yeah. And with any luck at all, will mitigate any negatives. But, you know, that happens in genetically related families anyway, so.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's funny. I'm trying to remember, it was a couple of years ago, and we were, in fact, Han Feng, Elise's godmother, had designed some costumes for the English National Opera, their production of Madama, the Anthony Minghella version of Madama Butterfly. So we were in London with Han Feng, and they had a cast party afterwards, and Elise was the life of the party. And she was walking around, she was charming people, she was laughing, she was having her picture taken with everyone in the opera. And my longtime colleague at NPR, Deborah Amos, and her husband Rick were there. And she said she was watching Elise work the room, being so gregarious and so friendly. And she came over to me and she said, you know, seeing your daughter here tonight, that old nature versus nurture question is settled for me. but I explained to her, Elise has always been that way. I mean, since, you know, the third or fourth day we got her, we were referring to her, but the first week we were referring to her as little Bill Clinton. Mm. She's just very friendly and very gregarious. And so there's something in her nature before we even got to her. Now, we encourage that. Absolutely, we encourage that. We're the kind of parents who do that. I think our challenge, and I don't want to make it sound like it's a big challenge, we have to be open to recognizing those traits that she may have that we can't, you know, that absolutely in no way we recognize from our own experience. So, I mean, my wife and I are both from artistic families, or allegedly artistic families. So when Elise and Lena, if they, you know, develop skills and traits that are consistent with, or wouldn't it be great to have someone who's good at math finally in the family, or they want to be accountants or something like that, we have to encourage that as much as we do their ballet or their singing or their music. And we're prepared to. I think that's great. I would, you know, somebody has to be responsible for the rest of the family. So if we have two daughters who are gifted in that direction, I think that's great.
Your book makes a really good case for adoption, and I have to praise the book in it's so open and honest, and I've never met you before, clearly, but if the Scott Simon that emerges in this book is anything like the real Scott Simon, then you're a heck of a guy, and I appreciate the fact that you are trying to do good with this book.
We're trying to, I don't mind saying we're trying to open a window into adoption for people, because we do just believe it's, well, we believe in it, you know? We believe it's a transforming experience.
It certainly works for you.
Yeah, it has. But, you know, and it works for a lot of people. It
works for my cousin Nancy. Those girls are great.
One of the very nice things about publishing the book is that I've heard from people really all over the world at this particular point who are sharing their own stories. I mean, it works. I also think, without pretending I know much about the physiology, or I know anything about the physiology involved, I think we're wired to do that. I think a lot of human beings are just wired to take care of children who, for one reason or another, are left aside by life. I think it's the instinct is as old as procreation, really.
I think you're right. It's been wonderful talking to you. I've been speaking with Scott Simon. The title of his book is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, published by Random House. Come through town again. Stop by.
Thank you. My pleasure.